ring binders, pencils, or pens. He has his own felt-tipped pens.
I might have to show him some material that could stimulate him, Graham said.
You can show him what you like as long as it's on soft paper. Pass him documents through the sliding food tray. Don't hand anything through the barrier, and do not accept anything he might extend through the barrier. He can return papers in the food tray. I insist on that. Dr. Bloom and Mr. Crawford assured me that you would cooperate on procedure.
I will, Graham said. He started to rise.
I know you're anxious to get on with it, Mr. Graham, but I want to tell you something first. This will interest you. It may seem gratuitous to warn you of all people about Lecter, but he's very disarming. For a year after he was brought here, he behaved perfectly and gave the appearance of cooperating with attempts at therapy. As a result, this was under the previous administrator, security around him was slightly relaxed. On the afternoon of July 8th, 1976, he complained of chest pain. His restraints were removed in the examining room to make it easier to give him an electrocardiogram. One of his attendants left the room to smoke, and the other turned away for a second. The nurse was very quick and strong. She managed to save one of her eyes. You may find this curious. Chilton took a strip of EKG tape from a drawer and unrolled it on his desk. He traced the spiky line with his forefinger. Here he's resting on the examining table, pulse 72. Here he grabs the nurse's head and pulls her down to him. Here he is subdued by the attendant. He didn't resist, by the way, though the attendant dislocated his shoulder. You notice the strange thing? His pulse never got over 85, even when he tore out her tongue. Chilton could read nothing in Graham's face. He leaned back in his chair and steepled his fingers under his chin. His hands were dry and shiny. You know, when Lecter was first captured, we thought he might provide us with a singular opportunity to study a pure sociopath, Chilton said. It's so rare to get one alive. Lecter is so lucid, so perceptive. He's trained in psychiatry. And he's a mass murderer. He seemed cooperative, and we thought that he could be a window on this kind of aberration. We thought we'd be like Beaumont, studying digestion through the opening in St. Martin's stomach. As it turned out, I don't think we're any closer to understanding him now than the day he came in. Have you ever talked with Lecter for any length of time?
No. I just saw him when...
I saw him mainly in court. Dr. Bloom showed me his articles in the journals, Graham said. He's very familiar with you. He's given you a lot of thought.
You had some sessions with him?
Yes, 12. He's impenetrable, too sophisticated about the tests for them to register anything. Edwards, Fabre, even Dr. Bloom himself had a crack at him. I have their notes. He was an enigma to them, too. It's impossible, of course, to tell what he's holding back or whether he understands more than he'll say. Oh, since his commitment, he's done some brilliant pieces for the American Journal of Psychiatry and the General Archives. But they're always about problems he doesn't have. I think he's afraid that if we solve him, nobody will be interested in him anymore. And he'll be stuck in a back ward somewhere for the rest of his life. Chilton paused. He had practiced using his peripheral vision to watch his subject in interviews. He believed that he could watch Graham this way undetected. The consensus around here is that the only person who has demonstrated any practical understanding of Hannibal Lecter is you, Mr. Graham. Can you tell me anything about him?
No.
Some of the staff are curious about this. When you saw Dr. Lecter's murders, their style, so to speak, were you able, perhaps, to reconstruct his fantasies? And did that help you identify him?
Graham did not answer. We're woefully short of material on that sort of thing. There's one single piece in the Journal of Abnormal Psychology. Would you mind talking with some of the staff? No, not this trip. Dr. Bloom was very severe with me on that point. We're to leave you alone. Next trip, perhaps. Dr. Chilton had seen a lot of hostility. He was seeing some at the moment. Graham stood up. Thank you, Doctor. I want to see Lecter now. The steel door of the maximum security section closed behind Graham. He heard the bolt slide home. Graham knew that Lecter slept most of the morning. He looked down the corridor. At that angle, he could not see into Lecter's cell, but he could tell that the lights inside were dimmed. Graham wanted to see Dr. Lecter asleep. He wanted time to brace himself. If he felt Lecter's madness in his head, he had to contain it quickly, like a spill. To cover the sound of his footsteps, he followed an orderly pushing a linen cart. Dr. Lecter is very difficult to slip up on. Graham paused partway down the hall. Steel bars covered the entire front of the cell. Behind the bars, farther than arm's reach, was a stout nylon net stretched ceiling to floor and wall to wall. Through the barrier, Graham could see a table and a chair bolted to the floor. The table was stacked with softcover books and correspondence. He walked up to the bars, put his hands on them, took his hands away. Dr. Hannibal Lecter lay on his cot, asleep, his head propped on a pillow against the wall. Alexandre Dumas' Le Grand Dictionnaire de Cuisine was open on his chest. Graham had stared through the bars for about 5 seconds when Lecter opened his eyes and said, "That's the same atrocious aftershave you wore in court. I keep getting it for Christmas." Dr. Lecter's eyes are maroon, and they reflect the light redly in tiny points. Graham felt each hair bristle on his nape. He put his hand on the back of his neck. "Christmas, yes," Lecter said. "Did you get my card?" "I got it. Thank you." Dr. Lecter's Christmas card had been forwarded to Graham from the FBI crime laboratory in Washington. He took it into the backyard, burned it, and washed his hands before touching Molly. Lecter rose and walked over to his table. He is a small, lithe man, very neat. "Why don't you have a seat, Will? I think there are some folding chairs in a closet just down that way. At least, that's where it sounds like they come from." The orderly's bringing one. Lecter stood until Graham was seated in the hall. "And how is Officer Stewart?" he asked. "Stewart's fine. Officer Stewart left law enforcement after he saw Dr. Lecter's basement. He managed a motel now. Graham did not mention this. He didn't think Stewart would appreciate any mail from Lecter. Unfortunate that his emotional problems got the better of him. I thought he was a very promising young officer. Do you ever have any problems, Will?"
"No."
"Of course you don't." Graham felt that Lecter was looking through to the back of his skull. His attention felt like a fly walking around in there.
"I'm glad you came. It's been, what now, 3 years?
My callers are all professional, banal clinical psychiatrists, and grasping second-rate doctors of psychology from silo colleges somewhere. Pencil lickers trying to protect their tenure with pieces in the journals. Dr. Bloom showed me your article on surgical addiction in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry."
"And?"
"Very interesting, even to a layman."
"A layman. Layman. Interesting term,"
Lecter said. So many learned fellows going about, so many experts on government grants. And you say you're a layman. But it was you who caught me, wasn't it, Will? Do you know how you did it? I'm sure you've read the transcript. It's all in there. No, it's not. Do you know how you did it, Will? It's in the transcript. What does it matter now? It doesn't matter to me, Will. I want you to help me, Dr. Lecter.
Yes, I thought so.
It's about Atlanta and Birmingham.
Yes.
You read about it, I'm sure.
I've read the papers. I can't clip them. They won't let me have scissors, of course.
Sometimes they threaten me with loss of books, you know. I wouldn't want him to think I was dwelling on anything morbid. He laughed. Dr. Lecter has small white teeth. You want to know how he's choosing them, don't you? I thought you would have some ideas. I'm asking you to tell me what they are.
Why should I?
Graham had anticipated the question. A reason to stop multiple murders would not occur readily to Dr. Lecter. There are things you don't have, Graham said. Research materials, film strips even. I'd speak to the chief of staff.
Chilton? You must have seen him when you came in. Gruesome, isn't it? Tell me the truth. He fumbles at your head like a freshman pulling at a panty girdle, doesn't he? Watched you out of the corner of his eye. Picked that up, didn't you?
You may not believe this, but he actually tried to give me a thematic apperception test. He was sitting there, just like the Cheshire Cat waiting for MF-13 to come up. Forgive me. I forget that you're not among the anointed. It's a card with a woman in bed and a man in the foreground. I was supposed to avoid a sexual interpretation. I laughed. He puffed up and told everybody, I avoided prison with a Ganser syndrome. Never mind. It's boring. You'd have access to the AMA film strip library. I don't think you'd get me the things I want. Try me. I have quite enough to read as it is. You'd get to see the file on this case. There's another reason.
Pray.
I thought you might be curious to find out if you're smarter than the person I'm looking for. Then, by implication, you think you are smarter than I am, since you caught me.
No, I know I'm not smarter than you are.
Then how did you catch me, Will?
You had disadvantages.
What disadvantages?
Passion.
And you're insane.
You're very tan, Will.
Graham did not answer. Your hands are rough. They don't look like a cop's hands anymore. That shaving lotion is something a child would select. It has a ship on the bottle, doesn't it?
Dr. Lecter seldom holds his head upright. He tilts it as he asks a question, as though he were screwing an augur of curiosity into your face.
Another silence, and Lecter said,
"Don't think you can persuade me with appeals to my intellectual vanity."
"I don't think I'll persuade you. You'll do it or you won't. Dr. Bloom is working on it anyway, and he's the most..."
"Do you have the file with you?"
"Yes."
"And pictures?"
"Yes."
"Let me have them, and I might consider it."
"No."
"Do you dream much, Will?"
"Goodbye, Dr. Lecter."
"You haven't threatened to take away my books yet."
Graham walked away.
"Let me have the file, then. I'll tell you what I think."
Graham had to pack the abridged file tightly into the sliding tray. Lecter pulled it through. "There's a summary on top. You can read that now. Graham said. Do you mind if I do it privately? Give me an hour. Graham waited on a tired plastic couch in a grim lounge. Orderlies came in for coffee. He did not speak to them. He stared at small objects in the room and was glad they held still in his vision. He had to go to the restroom twice. He was numb. The turnkey admitted him to the maximum security section again. Lecter sat at his table, his eyes filmed with thought. Graham knew he had spent most of the hour with the pictures. "This is a very shy boy, Will. I'd love to meet him. Have you considered the possibility that he's disfigured? Or that he may believe he's disfigured?" The mirrors. "Yes. You notice he smashed all the mirrors in the houses, not just enough to get the pieces he wanted. He doesn't just put the shards in place for the damage they cause. They're set so he can see himself in their eyes. Mrs. Jacoby and, what was the other name? Mrs. Leeds. Yes. That's interesting, Graham said. It's not interesting. You'd thought of that before.
I had considered it.
You just came here to look at me, just to get the old scent again, didn't you? Why don't you just smell yourself?
I want your opinion.
I don't have one right now.
When you do have one, I'd like to hear it.
May I keep the file?
I haven't decided yet, Graham said.
Why are there no descriptions of the grounds? Here we have frontal views of the houses, floor plans, diagrams of the rooms where the deaths occurred, and little mention of the grounds. What were the yards like?
Big backyards, fenced with some hedges.
Why? Because, my dear Will, if this pilgrim feels a special relationship with the moon, he might like to go outside and look at it, before he tidies himself up, you understand. Have you seen blood in the moonlight, Will? It appears quite black. Of course, it keeps the distinctive sheen. If one were nude, say, it would be better to have outdoor privacy for that sort of thing. One must show some consideration for the neighbors.
You think the yard might be a factor when he selects victims?
Oh, yes. And there will be more victims, of course. Let me keep the file, Will. I'll study it. When you get more files, I'd like to see them, too. You can call me. On the rare occasions when my lawyer calls, they bring me a telephone. They used to patch him through on the intercom, but everyone listened, of course. Would you like to give me your home number?
No.
Do you know how you caught me, Will?
Goodbye, Dr. Lecter. You can leave messages for me at the number on the file. Graham walked away.
Do you know how you caught me?
Graham was out of Lecter's sight now, and he walked faster toward the far steel door.
The reason you caught me is that we're just alike,
was the last thing Graham heard as the steel door closed behind him. He was numb, except for dreading the loss of numbness. Walking with his head down, speaking to no one, he could hear his blood like a hollow drumming of wings. It seemed a very short distance to the outside. This was only a building. There were only 5 doors between Lecter and the outside. He had the absurd feeling that Lecter had walked out with him. He stopped outside the entrance and looked around him, assuring himself that he was alone. From a car across the street, his long lens propped on the windowsill, Freddy Lowndes got a nice profile shot of Graham in the doorway, and the words in stone above him, Baltimore State Hospital for the Criminally Insane.
As it turned out, the National Tattler cropped the picture to just Graham's face and the last two words in the stone. Chapter 8. Dr. Hannibal Lecter lay on his cot with the cell lights down after Graham left him. Several hours passed. For a while, he had textures, the weave of the pillowcase against his hands clasped behind his head, the smooth membrane that lined his cheek. Then he had odors, and let his mind play over them. Some were real, some were not. They had put Clorox in the drains, semen. They were serving chili down the hall, sweat-stiffened khaki. Graham would not give him his home telephone number. The bitter green smell of cut cockle burr and tea-weed. Lecter sat up. The man might have been civil. His thoughts had the warm, brass smell of an electric clock. Lecter blinked several times, and his eyebrows rose. He turned up the lights and wrote a note to Chilton, asking for a telephone to call his counsel. Lecter was entitled by law to speak with his lawyer in privacy, and he hadn't abused the right. Since Chilton would never allow him to go to the telephone was brought to him. Two guards brought it, unrolling a long cord from the telephone jack at their desk. One of the guards had the keys, the other held a can of mace. "Go to the back of the cell, Dr. Lecter. Face the wall. If you turn around or approach the barrier before you hear the lock snap, I'll mace you in the face. Understand?" "Yes, indeed," Lecter said. "Thank you so much for bringing the telephone." He had to reach through the nylon net to dial. Chicago Information gave him numbers for the University of Chicago Department of Psychiatry and Dr. Alan Bloom's office number. He dialed the psychiatry department switchboard. "I'm trying to reach Dr. Alan Bloom. I'm not sure he's in today, but I'll connect you. Just a second. I'm supposed to know his secretary's name, and I'm embarrassed to say I've forgotten it. Linda King. Just a moment. Thank you." The telephone rang 8 times before it was picked up. "Linda King's desk." "Hi, Linda." "Linda doesn't come in on Saturday." Dr. Lecter had counted on that. "Maybe you could help me, if you don't mind. This is Bob Greer at Blaine and Edwards Publishing Company. Dr. Bloom asked me to send a copy of the Overholser book, The Psychiatrist and the Law, to Will Graham, and Linda was supposed to send me the address and phone number, but she never did." "I'm just a graduate assistant. She'll be in on I have to catch Federal Express with it in about 5 minutes, and I hate to bother Dr. Bloom about it at home, because he told Linda to send it, and I don't want to get her in hot water. It's right there in her Rolodex, or whatever. I'll dance at your wedding if you'll read it to me." "She doesn't have a Rolodex." "How about a coal caddy with the slide on the side?" "Yes." "Be a darling and slide that rascal, and I won't take up any more of your time." "What was the name?" "Graham. Will Graham." "All right. His home number is 305-JL5-7002. "I'm supposed to mail it to his house." "It doesn't give the address of his house." "What does it have?" "Federal Bureau of Investigation, 10th and Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C. Oh, and Post Office Box 3680, Marathon, Florida." "That's fine. You're an angel." "You're welcome." Lecter felt much better. He thought he might surprise Graham with a call sometime. Or if the man couldn't be civil, he might have a hospital supply house mail Graham a colostomy bag, for old time's sake. Chapter 9. 700 miles to the southwest, in the cafeteria at Gateway Film Laboratory of St. Louis, Francis Dollarhide was waiting for a hamburger. The entrees offered in the steam table were filmed over. He stood beside the cash register and sipped coffee from a paper cup. A red-haired young woman wearing a laboratory smock came into the cafeteria and studied the candy machine. She looked at Frances Dolarhyde's back several times and pursed her lips. Finally, she walked over to him and said, "Mr. D?" Dolarhyde turned. He always wore red goggles outside the dark room. She kept her eyes on the nosepiece of the goggles.
"Will you sit down with me a minute? I want to tell you something."
"What can you tell me, Eileen?"
"That I'm really sorry. Bob was just really drunk, and, you know, clowning around. He didn't mean anything. Please come sit down, just for a minute. Will you do that?"
"Mm-hmm." Dolarhyde never said yes, as he had trouble with the sibilant S. They sat. She twisted a napkin in her hands. "Everybody was having a good time at the party, and we were glad you came by," she said. "Real glad and surprised, too. You know how Bob is. He does voices all the time. He ought to be on the radio. He did two or three accents telling jokes and all. He can talk just like a Negro. When he did that other voice, he didn't mean to make you feel bad. He was too drunk to know who was there." They were all laughing, and then they didn't laugh. Dolarhyde never said stopped because of the fricative S. "That's when Bob realized what he had done." He went on, though. "I know it," she said, managing to look from her napkin to his goggles without lingering on the way. "I got on his case about it, too. He said he didn't mean anything. He just saw he was into it and tried to keep up the joke. You saw how red his face got." "He invited me to perform a duet with him." "He hugged you and tried to put his arm around you. He wanted you to laugh it off, Mr. D." "I've laughed it off, Eileen."
"Bob feels terrible."
"Well, I don't want him to feel terrible. I don't want that. Tell him for me. And it won't make it any different here at the plant. Golly, if I had talent like Bob, I'd make a joke all the time."
Dolarhyde avoided plurals whenever he could.
"We'll all get together before long, and he'll know how I feel."
"Good, Mr. D. You know, he's really under all the fun. He's a sensitive guy."
"I'll bet. Tender, I imagine."
Dolarhyde's voice was muffled by his hand. When seated, he always pressed the knuckle of his forefinger under his nose.
"Pardon?" "I think you're good for him, Eileen."
"I think so, I really do. He's not drinking, but just on weekends. He just starts to relax and his wife calls the house. He makes faces while I talk to her, but I can tell he's upset after. A woman knows." She tapped Dolarhyde on the wrist, and despite the goggles, saw the touch register in his eyes. "Take it easy, Mr. D. I'm glad we had this talk."
"I am too, Eileen."
Dolarhyde watched her walk away. She had a suck mark on the back of her knee. He thought correctly that Eileen did not appreciate him. No one did, actually. The great darkroom was cool and smelled of chemicals. Frances Dolarhyde checked the developer in the A tank. Hundreds of feet of home movie film from all over the country moved through the tank hourly. Temperature and freshness of the chemicals were critical. This was his responsibility, along with all the other operations, until the film had passed through the dryer. Many times a day he lifted samples of film from the tank and checked them frame by frame. The dark room was quiet. Dolarhyde discouraged chatter among his assistants and communicated with them largely in gestures. When the evening shift ended, he remained alone in the darkroom to develop, dry, and splice some film of his own. Dolarhyde got home about 10 p.m. He lived alone in a big house his grandparents had left him. It stood at the end of a gravel drive that runs through an apple orchard north of St. Charles, Missouri, across the Missouri River from St. Louis. The orchard's absentee owner did not take care of it. Dead and twisted trees stood among the green ones. Now, in late July, the smell of rotting apples hung over the orchard. There were many bees in the daytime. The nearest neighbor was a half mile away. Dollarhide always made an inspection tour of the house as soon as he got home. There had been an abortive burglary attempt some years before. He flicked on the lights in each room and looked around. A visitor would not think he lived alone. His grandparents' clothes still hung in the closets. His grandmother's brushes were on her dresser, with combings of hair in them. Her teeth were in a glass on the bedside table. The water had long since evaporated. His grandmother had been dead for 10 years. The funeral director had asked him, "Mr. Dollarhide, wouldn't you like to bring me your grandmother's teeth?" He replied, "Just drop the lid." Satisfied that he was alone in the house, Dollarhide went upstairs, took a long shower, and washed his hair. He put on a kimono of a synthetic material that felt like silk, and lay down on his narrow bed in the room he had occupied since childhood. His grandmother's hair dryer had a plastic cap and hose. He put on the cap, and while he dried, he thumbed through a new high-fashion magazine. The hatred and brutishness in some of the photographs were remarkable. He began to feel excited. He swiveled the metal shade of his reading lamp to light a print on the wall at the foot of the bed. It was William Blake's "The Great Red Dragon and the Woman Clothed with the Sun." The picture had stunned him the first time he saw it. Never before had he seen anything that approached his graphic thought. He felt that Blake must have peeked in his ear and seen the Red Dragon. For weeks, Dollarhide had worried that his thoughts might glow out his ears, might be visible in the darkroom, might fog the film. He put cotton balls in his ears. Then, fearing that cotton was too flammable, he tried steel wool. That made his ears bleed. Finally, he cut small pieces of asbestos cloth from an ironing board cover and rolled them into little pills that would fit in his ears. The Red Dragon was all he had for a long time. It was not all he had now. He felt the beginnings of an erection. He had wanted to go through this slowly, but now he could not wait. Dollarhide closed the heavy draperies over windows in the downstairs parlor. He set up his screen and projector. His grandfather had put a Lazy Boy recliner in the parlor over his grandmother's objections. She had put a doily on the headrest. Now Dollarhide was glad. It was very comfortable. He draped a towel over the arm of the chair. He turned out the lamps. Lying back in the dark room, he might have been anywhere. Over the ceiling fixture, he had a good light machine which rotated, making varicolored dots of light crawl over the walls, the floor, his skin. He might have been reclining on the acceleration couch of a space vehicle in a glass bubble out among the stars. When he closed his eyes, he thought he could feel the points of light move over him, and when he opened them, those might be the lights of cities above or beneath him. There was no more down or up. The light machine turned faster as it got warm, and the dots swarmed over him, flowed over furniture in angular streams, fell in meteor showers down the walls. He might have been a comet plunging through the Crab Nebula. There was one place shielded from the light. He had placed a piece of cardboard near the machine, and it cast a shadow over the movie screen. Sometimes, in the future, he would smoke first to heighten the effect, but he did not need it now, this time. He thumbed the drop switch at his side to start the projector. A white rectangle sprang on the screen, grayed and streaked as the leader moved past the lens, and then the gray Scotty perked up his ears, and ran to the kitchen door, shivering and wagging his stump of a tail. A cut to the Scotty running beside a curb, turning to snap at his side as he ran. Now Mrs. Leeds came into the kitchen, carrying groceries. She laughed and touched her hair. The children came in behind her. A cut to a badly lit shot in Dollarhide's own bedroom upstairs. He is standing nude before the print of the great red dragon and the woman clothed with the sun. He is wearing combat glasses, the close-fitting wraparound plastic glasses favored by hockey players. He has an erection, which he improves with his hand. The focus blurs as he approaches the camera with stylized movements, hand reaching to change the focus as his face fills the frame. The picture quivers and sharpens suddenly to a close-up of his mouth, his disfigured upper lip rolled back, tongue out through the teeth, one rolling eye still in the frame. The mouth fills the screen, writhing lips pulled back from jagged teeth, and darkness as his mouth engulfs the lens. The difficulty of the next part was evident. A bouncing blur in a harsh movie light became a bed and Charles Leeds thrashing, Mrs. Leeds sitting up, shielding her eyes, turning to Leeds and putting her hands on him, rolling toward the edge of the bed, legs tangled in the covers, trying to rise. The camera jerked toward the ceiling, molding whipping across the screen like a stave, and then the picture steadied. Mrs. Leeds back down on the mattress, a dark spot on her nightdress spreading, and Leeds, hands to his neck and eyes wild rising. The screen went black for 5 beats, then the tick of a splice. The camera was steady now, on a tripod. They were all dead now, arranged. 2 children seated against the wall facing the bed, 1 seated across the corner from them facing the camera. Mr. and Mrs. Leeds in bed with the covers over them. Mr. Leeds propped up against the headboard, the sheet covering the rope around his chest, and his head lolled to the side. Dollarhide came into the picture from the left with the stylized movements of a Balinese dancer. Blood-smeared and naked, except for his glasses and gloves, he mugged and capered among the dead. He approached the far side of the bed, Mrs. Leeds' side, took the corner of the covers, whipped them off the bed, and held the pose as though he had executed a Veronica. Now, watching in the parlor of his grandparents' house, Dollarhide was covered with a sheen of sweat. His thick tongue ran out constantly, the scar on his upper lip wet and shiny, and he moaned as he stimulated himself. Even at the height of his pleasure, he was sorry to see that in the film's ensuing scene, he lost all his grace and elegance of motion, rooting pig-like with his bottom turned carelessly to the camera. There were no dramatic pauses, no sense of pace or climax, just brutish frenzy. It was wonderful anyway. Watching the film was wonderful, but not as wonderful as the acts themselves. 2 major flaws, Dollarhide felt, were that the film did not actually show the deaths of the Leedses, and that his own performance was poor toward the end. He seemed to lose all his values. That was not how the Red Dragon would do it. Well, he had many films to make, and with experience he hoped he could maintain some aesthetic distance, even in the most intimate moments. He must bear down. This was his life's work, a magnificent thing. It would live forever. He must press on soon. He must select his fellow performers. Already he had copied several films of 4th of July family outings. The end of summer always brought a rush of business at the film processing plant as vacation movies came in. Thanksgiving would bring another rush. Families were mailing their applications to him every day. Chapter 10. The plane from Washington to Birmingham was half empty. Graham took a window seat with no one beside him. He declined the tired sandwich the stewardess offered and put his Jacobi file on the tray table. At the front, he had listed the similarities between the Jacobis and the Leedses. Both couples were in their late 30s. Both had children, 2 boys and a girl. Edward Jacobi had another son by a previous marriage, who was away at college when the family was killed. Both parents in each case had college degrees, and both families lived in 2-story houses in pleasant suburbs. Mrs. Jacobi and Mrs. Leeds were attractive women. The families had some of the same credit cards, and they subscribed to some of the same popular magazines. There, the similarities ended. Charles Leeds was a tax attorney, while Edward Jacobi was an engineer and metallurgist. The Atlanta family were Presbyterian. The Jacobis were Catholic. The Leedses were lifelong Atlanta residents, while the Jacobis had lived in Birmingham only 3 months, transferred there from Detroit. The word random sounded in Graham's head like a dripping faucet. Random selection of victims. No apparent motive. Newspapers use those terms, and detectives spat them out in anger and frustration in homicide squad rooms. Random wasn't accurate, though. Graham knew that mass murderers and serial murderers do not select their victims at random. The man who killed the Jacobis and the Leedses saw something in them that drew him and drove him to do it. He might have known them well. Graham hoped so. Or he might not have known them at all. But Graham was sure the killer saw them at some time before he killed them. He chose them because something in them spoke to him, and the women were at the core of it. What was it? There were some differences in the crimes. Edward Jacobi was shot as he came down the stairs carrying a flashlight. Probably he was awakened by a noise. Mrs. Jacobi and her children were shot in the head, Mrs. Leeds in the abdomen. The weapon was a 9mm automatic pistol in all the shootings. Traces of steel wool from a homemade silencer were found in the wounds. The cartridge cases bore no fingerprints. The knife had been used only on Charles Leeds. Dr. Princi believed it was thin-bladed and very keen, possibly a filleting knife. The methods of entry were different, too. A patio door pried open at the Jacobis, the glass cutter at the Leedses. Photographs of the crime in Birmingham did not show the quantity of blood found at the Leedses, but there were stains on the bedroom walls, about 2.5 feet above the floor. So the killer had an audience in Birmingham, too. The Birmingham police checked the bodies for fingerprints, including the fingernails, and found nothing. Burial for a summer month in Birmingham would destroy any prints like the one on the Leeds child. In both places were the same blonde hairs, same spit, same semen. Graham propped photographs of the 2 smiling families against the seat back in front of him and stared at them for a long time in the hanging quiet of the airplane. What could have attracted the murderer specifically to them? Graham wanted very much to believe there was a common factor and that he would find it soon. Otherwise, he would have to enter more houses and see what the tooth fairy had left for him. Graham got directions from the Birmingham field office and checked in with the police by telephone from the airport. The compact car he rented spit water from the air conditioner vents onto his hands and arms. His first stop was the Guillen Realty office on Denison Avenue. Guillen, tall and bald, made haste across his turquoise shag to greet Graham. His smile faded when Graham showed his identification and asked for the key to the Jacobi house. "Will there be some cops in uniform out there today?" he asked, his hand on the top of his head. "I don't know. I hope to God not. I got a chance to show it twice this afternoon. It's a nice house. People see it and they forget this other. Last Thursday, I had a couple from Duluth, substantial retired people, hot on the Sun Belt. I had them down to the short rows, talking mortgages. I mean, that man could have fronted a third when the squad car rode up, and in they came. Couple asked them questions, and boy, did they get some answers. These good officers gave them the whole tour, who was laying where. And then it was goodbye, Gian. Much obliged for your trouble. I try to show them how safe we've fixed it, but they don't listen. There they go, Jake-legged through the gravel, climbing back in their sedan de ville. Have any single men asked to look at it? They haven't asked me. It's a multiple listing. I don't think so, though. Police wouldn't let us start painting until, I don't know, we just got finished inside last Tuesday. Took 2 coats of interior latex, 3 in places. We're still working outside. It'll be a genuine showplace.
How can you sell it before the estate's probated?
I can't close until probate, but that doesn't mean I can't be ready. People could move in on a memorandum of understanding. I need to do something. A business associate of mine is holding the paper, and that interest just works all day and all night while you're asleep.
Who is Mr. Jacoby's executor?
Byron Metcalf, firm of Metcalf and Barnes. How long you figure on being out there?
I don't know, until I've finished.
You can drop that key in the mail. You don't have to come back by.
Graham had the flat feeling of a cold trail as he drove out to the Jacoby house. It was barely within the city limits in an area newly annexed. He stopped beside the highway once to check his map before he found the turnoff onto an asphalt secondary road. More than a month had passed since they were killed. What had he been doing then? Putting a pair of diesels in a 65-foot Rybovich hull, signaling to Arriaga in the crane to come down another half-inch. Molly came over in the late afternoon, and he and Molly and Arriaga sat under an awning in the cockpit of the half-finished boat and ate the big prawns Molly brought and drank cold Dos Equis beer. Arriaga explained the best way to clean crayfish, drawing the tail fan in sawdust on the deck, and the sunlight, broken on the water, played on the undersides of the wheeling gulls. Water from the air conditioner squirted on the front of Graham's shirt, and he was in Birmingham now, and there were no prawns or gulls. He was driving, and pastures and wooded lots were on his right, with goats and horses in them. And on his left was Stonebridge, a long-established residential area with a few elegant homes and a number of rich people's houses. He saw the realtor's sign 100 yards before he reached it. The Jacoby house was the only one on the right side of the road. Sap from the pecan trees beside the drive had made the gravel sticky, and it rattled inside the fenders of the car. A carpenter on a ladder was installing window guards. A workman raised a hand to Graham as he walked around the house. A flagged patio at the side was shaded by a large oak tree. At night, the tree would block out the floodlight in the side yard as well. This was where the Tooth Fairy had entered, through sliding glass doors. The doors had been replaced with new ones, the aluminum frames still bright and bearing the manufacturer's sticker. Covering the sliding doors was a new wrought iron security gate. The basement door was new too, flushed steel and secured by deadbolts. The components of a hot tub stood in crates on the flagstones. Graham went inside. Bare floors and dead air. His footsteps echoed in the empty house. The new mirrors in the bathrooms had never reflected the Jacobis' faces or the killer's. On each was a fuzzy white spot where the price had been torn off. A folded drop cloth lay in a corner of the master bedroom. Graham sat on it long enough for the sunlight through the bare windows to move one board width across the floor. There was nothing here. Nothing anymore. If he had come here immediately after the Jacobis were killed, would the Leedses still be alive? Graham wondered. He tested the weight of that burden.
It did not lift when he was out of the house and under the sky again. Graham stood in the shade of a pecan tree, shoulders hunched, hands in his pockets, and looked down the long drive to the road that passed in front of the Jacoby house. How had the Tooth Fairy come to the Jacoby house? He had to drive. Where did he park? The gravel driveway was too noisy for a midnight visit, Graham thought. The Birmingham police did not agree. He walked down the drive to the roadside. The asphalt road was bordered with ditches as far as he could see. It might be possible to pull across the ditch and hide a vehicle in the brush on the Jacoby's side of the road if the ground were hard and dry. Facing the Jacoby house across the road was the single entrance to Stonebridge. The sign said that Stonebridge had a private patrol service. A strange vehicle would be noticed there. So would a man walking late at night. Scratch parking in Stonebridge. Graham went back into the house and was surprised to find the telephone working. He called the Weather Bureau and learned that 3 inches of rain fell on the day before the Jacobys were killed. The ditches were full then. The Tooth Fairy did not hide his vehicle beside the asphalt road. A horse in the pasture beside the yard kept pace with Graham as he walked along the whitewashed fence toward the rear of the property. He gave the horse a lifesaver and left him at the corner as he turned along the back fence behind the outbuildings. He stopped when he saw the depression in the ground where the Jacoby children had buried their cat. Thinking about it in the Atlanta police station with Springfield, he had pictured the outbuildings as white. Actually, they were dark green. The children had wrapped the cat in a dish towel and buried it in a shoebox with a flower between its paws. Graham rested his forearm on top of the fence and leaned his forehead against it. A pet funeral, solemn rite of childhood. Parents going back into the house, ashamed to pray. The children looking at one another, discovering new nerves in the place loss pierces. One bows her head, then they all do, the shovel taller than any of them. Afterward, a discussion of whether or not the cat is in heaven with God and Jesus, and the children don't shout for a while. A certainty came to Graham as he stood, sun hot on the back of his neck. As surely as the Tooth Fairy killed the cat, he had watched the children bury it. He had to see that if he possibly could. He did not make 2 trips out here, one to kill the cat and the second for the Jacobys. He came and killed the cat and waited for the children to find it. There was no way to determine exactly where the children found the cat. The police had located no one who spoke to the Jacobys after noon, 10 hours or so before they died. How had the Tooth Fairy come, and where had he waited? Behind the back fence, the brush began, running head high for 30 yards to the trees. Graham dug his wrinkled map out of his back pocket and spread it on the fence. It showed an unbroken strip of woods, 1/4 mile deep, running across the back of the Jacoby property and continuing in both directions. Beyond the woods, bounding them on the south, was a section line road that paralleled the one in front of the Jacoby house. Graham drove from the house back to the highway, measuring the distance on his odometer. He went south on the highway and turned onto the section line road he had seen on the map. Measuring again, he drove slowly along it until the odometer showed him he was behind the Jacoby house on the other side of the woods. Here, the pavement ended at a low-income housing project, so new it did not show on his map. He pulled into the parking lot. Most of the cars were old and sagging on their springs. 2 were up on blocks. Black children played basketball on the bare earth around a single netless goal. Graham sat on his fender to watch the game for a moment. He wanted to take off his jacket, But he knew the .44 Special and the flat camera on his belt would attract attention. He always felt a curious embarrassment when people looked at his pistol. There were 8 players on the team wearing shirts. The Skins had 11, all playing at once. Refereeing was by acclamation. A small Skin, shoved down in the rebounding, stalked home mad. He came back, fortified with a cookie, and dived into the pack again. The yelling and the thump of the ball lifted Graham's spirits. 1 goal, 1 basketball. It struck him again how many things the Leedses had. The Jacobys, too, according to the Birmingham police when they ruled out burglary. Boats and sporting equipment, camping equipment, cameras and guns and rods. It was another thing the families had in common. And with the thought of the Leedses and the Jacobys alive came the thought of how they were afterward, and Graham couldn't watch basketball anymore. He took a deep breath and headed for the dark woods across the road. The underbrush, heavy at the edge of the pine woods, thinned when Graham reached the deep shade, and he had easy going over the pine needles. The air was warm and still. Blue jays in the trees ahead announced his coming. The ground sloped gently to a dry stream bed where a few cypresses grew, and the tracks of raccoons and field mice were pressed into the red clay. A number of human footprints marked the stream bed, some of them left by children. All were caved in and rounded, left several rains ago. Past the stream bed, the land rose again, changing to sandy loam that supported ferns beneath the pines. Graham worked his way uphill in the heat until he saw the light beneath the trees at the edge of the woods. Between the trunks, he could see the upper story of the Jacoby house. Undergrowth again, head high from the edge of the woods to the Jacoby's back fence. Graham worked his way through it and stood at the fence looking into the yard. The Tooth Fairy could have parked at the housing development and come through the woods to the brush behind the house. He could have lured the cat into the brush and choked it, the body limp in one hand as he crawled on his knees and the other hand to the fence. Graham could see the cat in the air, never twisting to land on its feet, but hitting on its back with a thump in the yard. The Tooth Fairy did that in daylight. The children would not have found or buried the cat at night. And he waited to see them find it. Did he wait for the rest of the day in the heat of the underbrush? At the fence, he would be visible through the rails. In order to see the yard from farther back in the brush, he would have to stand and face the windows of the house with the sun beating on him. Clearly, he would go back to the trees. So did Graham. The Birmingham police were not stupid. He could see where they had pushed through the brush, searching the area as a matter of course. But that was before the cat was found. They were looking for clues, dropped objects, tracks. Not for a vantage point. He went a few yards into the forest behind the Jacoby house and worked back and forth in the dappled shade. First, he took the high ground that afforded a partial view of the yard and then worked his way down the tree line. He had searched for more than an hour when a wink of light from the ground caught his eye. He lost it, found it again. It was the ring pull tab from a soft drink can, half buried in the leaves beneath an elm tree, one of the few elms among the pines. He spotted it from 8 feet away and went no closer for 5 minutes while he scanned the ground around the tree. He squatted and brushed the leaves away ahead of him as he approached the tree, duck walking in the path he made to avoid ruining any impressions. Working slowly, he cleared the leaves all around the trunk. No footprints had pressed through the mat of last year's leaves. Near the aluminum tab, he found a dried apple core, eaten thin by ants. Birds had pecked out the seeds. He studied the ground for 10 more minutes. Finally, he sat on the ground, stretched out his aching legs, and leaned back against the tree. A cone of gnats swarmed in a column of sunlight. A caterpillar rippled along the underside of a leaf. There was a wedge of Red Creek mud from the instep of a boot on the limb above his head. Graham hung his coat on a branch and began to climb carefully on the opposite side of the tree, peering around the trunk at the limbs above the wedge of mud. At 30 feet, he looked around the trunk, and there was the Jacoby house, 175 yards away. It looked different from this height, the roof color dominant. He could see the backyard and the ground behind the outbuildings very well. A decent pair of field glasses